You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Welcome to today's Brookings event on insecurity in Northeast Nigeria and beyond. I am Dr. Wanda Falbaugh-Brown, Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution and Director of the Initiative on Non-State Armed Actors and Co-Director of the Africa Security Initiative. The Brookings Initiative on Non-State Armed Actors seeks to advance policy-relevant knowledge of non-state armed actors and illicit economies in the United States and around the world. The Brookings Africa Security Initiative specifically focuses on a variety of threats and security challenges, as well as peace dynamics in Africa. As with all of Brookings' work, the predominant focus is on independent, objective, in-depth research that informs policy options and develops policy recommendations. For over a decade, Nigeria has struggled to address devastating jihadi insurgencies and terrorism by Boko Haram and the Islamic State in West Africa province, as well as other Boko Haram offshoots like Ansaru. Victory against those groups remains elusive, and security in northeastern Nigeria has significantly deteriorated since 2017. Insecurity is also intense in northwest Nigeria, where the farmers' herders conflict has generated vast deaths, perhaps up to 8,000, often exacerbated by intensifying effects of global warming. And despite a series of ceasefires, deals, amnesties, and promises to address issues of particularly the herders community, many of the conflict dynamics remain merely dormant rather than resolved. Militias abound in the northwest, just as they abound in the northeast, where groups like the Civilian Joint Task Force, CJTF, are key features in the struggle against jihadi insurgencies, such as Boko Haram and ISWAP. Both groups, as well as Ansaru, also have developed a presence in the northwest of Nigeria, where criminal gangs, robberies, cattle rustling, smuggling, kidnapping, all are very important features of the conflict. Just as illegal economies and captured economies play a significant role in the conflict in the northeast. These dynamics in the north of Nigeria are taking place as insecurity has also intensified in various other parts of the country, with the Nigerian military deployed to the vast majority of Nigerian states. Yet when Nigerians are demanding meaningful human security, as well as accountability from the often brutal military and law enforcement forces, most visibly and dramatically manifested in the movement against the Special Anti-Robbery Squad and the desire for its abolition and broader reform of the security sector. Layered over these issues are issues of poverty, inequality, lack of jobs, now also gravely compounded by the coronavirus pandemic. To discuss all of these issues with predominant focus on the North and Northeast, but going beyond that, I am joined today by a terrific panel. Ambassador John Campbell is the Ralph Buchan Senior Fellow for Africa Policy Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. After a very distinct, or including as part of his very distinguished career in foreign service, he was also the ambassador to Nigeria, the U.S. ambassador to Nigeria from 2004 to 2007. Ambassador Campbell is the author of a new superb book that is just newly out, Nigeria and the Nation State, Rethinking Diplomacy with the Post-Colonial World, that I highly recommend. And I look forward to the ambassador's insight based on the book and his very vast and distinguished experience. Dr. Takwa Swifon is a senior peace and development advisor to the resident coordinator and the United Nations country team in Nigeria. In that role since 2014, Dr. Swifon has dealt with a wide range of security and humanitarian issues in Nigeria, including providing technical support in the establishment of the National Peace Committee, as well as leading on behalf of UN, the governance and peace component of the Joint Recovery and Peacebuilding Assessment of the Northeast. And prior to those appointments, he worked at the African Union Commission. He also has an extensive publication record that I also highly recommend. I am very thrilled as well that Ms. Sophia Michael has been able to plug into the conversation. Ms. Michael is a humanitarian worker in Northeast Nigeria, having worked for the past 5 years with the Norwegian Refugee Council there. With a background in journalism, she has focused extensively and primarily on emergency humanitarian sector and has a great experience in deep field operations in Northeast Nigeria. I should remind all of us that perhaps at least 800,000 people in Northeast Nigeria are not living in areas that are accessible to the Nigerian government and or many humanitarian actors. And Ms. Michael has been dealing with many of those communities deep and far away from places like Maiduguri. And she is also a liaison representative for building relationship between the Norwegian Refugee Council, community leaders, and government agencies. Finally, but certainly not last, I am thrilled that Dr. Siobhan O'Neill is able to join the conversation. She is the project director of the United Nations University Initiative on Managing Exits from Armed Conflict. A multi-year, multi-agency collaboration, the initiative studies individual exits from armed conflict and evaluates policy intervention to support those exits and conflict mitigation. She has a stellar and tremendous record at UNU, where she directed other projects such as on children and extreme violence, and disarmament, demobilization, and reintegration. I had the pleasure to work with her in some of these projects. And prior to joining UNU, Dr. O'Neill held a variety of management and analysis position on the matter of US Homeland Security. She too has a very extensive publication record that I highly recommend. Ambassador Campbell, let me turn to you for the keynote opening remarks. Can you please situate what's going on in the Northeast, Northwest with anti-SARS protests in the broader picture of developments in political and state building developments in Nigeria over the past 20 years and longer? How does this fit the current insecurity? How does this fit into broader trends in the country?
Thank you very much, Vanda. It's a pleasure to be with you. I've been asked to look at the situation in Nigeria from, as it were, 30,000 feet. And I should also comment that what I am doing is looking at it from the perspective of the United States and Washington, not the perspective of Lagos, Abuja, or Port Harcourt. The first point I would like to make is that Nigeria, and in fact Africa in general, is becoming more and more important to the United States. Africa is more salient to the United States now than probably it ever has been in the history of American relations with Africa. Some indicators of that increased importance. I chose five. There are more that I could have talked about. Demography, security, disease, economic opportunity, and democracy and the rule of law. Demography. Africa, and specifically Nigeria, is undergoing a huge population boom. And in fact, UN experts estimate that by 2050, Nigeria may well displace the United States as the largest country in the world, third largest country in the world by population. This huge increase in population combined with poverty is likely to fuel migration out of Nigeria, both elsewhere in Africa, but also further afield, demography. Secondly, security. Jihadist groups are established in northern Nigeria, the Western Sahel, the Horn, and now Mozambique. And the links among them are controversial and by no means clear. I would suggest that at present, these jihadist groups do not pose a threat to the security of the United States, but they may well at some point in the future, just as Al-Qaeda used Afghanistan as a jumping off point for 9/11. So, demography, security. Thirdly, disease. The destruction of the rainforest in Africa will facilitate the jump of diseases from animals to humans. We have already seen this occur in the case of Ebola and also HIV. It has to be anticipated that this process will continue. Economic opportunities. With this huge increase in population, clearly there are potential markets for trade, investment, and participation in Africa's economic development. And finally, democracy and the rule of law, under any administration and American preoccupation, there is the potential in some African countries for a positive trajectory. But if Africa and Nigeria's importance to the United States is growing, in the shorter term, the paradox is Nigeria is less important to the United States now than it was in the first decade of the 20th century. Then, the U.S. imported 1 million barrels of oil a day from Nigeria, and successive Nigerian governments gave assurances that should Middle East's supplies of oil be interrupted for political reasons, Nigeria would do what it could to help fill the void. Now, the United States imports virtually no oil at all from Nigeria, largely because of fracking and because of Western hemisphere sources. Then Nigeria was a major source of peacekeepers for UN and AU peacekeeping missions. Particularly important where the United States could not and would not participate in peacekeeping missions. Now, because of internal security threats, Nigeria's peacekeeping role is sadly much diminished. Then, the first decade of the 21st century, Nigeria's 1999 transition from military to civilian rule promoted an optimism about the future of Nigeria's governance and as a model for the rest of the continent. Now, even though governance is civilian and has been for some 20 years, corruption remains endemic, and the government provides few, if any, services for the general population. Nigeria, as a democratic lodestar for Africa, is no longer really very credible. Well, what happened? While the declining importance of oil and the fall in international price of oil are certainly important, I would suggest that internal developments within Nigeria are more significant for the country's declining role on the world stage. First of all, insecurity. We're going to be talking this afternoon a great deal about the various jihadist movements in the Northeast, which we lump together usually under the label Boko Haram. I would point out, however, that this insecurity in the Northeast is also spreading to the Northwest. It's no longer concentrated in the Northeast. Fonda has already made reference to the Middle Belt, where quarrels over land and water exacerbate religious and ethnic conflicts. But then there is also the endemic low-level insurrection in the oil patch, something which I don't think we're paying enough attention to, because in fact, more than 90% of the Nigerian government's revenue still comes from oil. And if there's a significant shutdown of the oil production, how the Nigerian government can fund itself becomes questionable. But then for many Nigerians, perhaps what comes closest to home is the nationwide crime wave. This really covers the entire country, and it is particularly focused on kidnapping. I find it interesting that Kaduna is 180 kilometers away from Abuja, and there's a superhighway that connects the two. Kidnapping has become so ubiquitous along that highway that Aero Contractors, a Nigerian airline, now flies a regular shuttle service between the two cities because people are afraid to travel by road. Taken all together, Nigeria is no longer able to fulfill a key requirement of sovereignty. That is to say, providing security for its citizens. That in turn begs another question. Why? At one level, the Abuja government lacks a strong, well-funded military or security services in general. For example, the police number only 377,000, and the army numbers perhaps 100,000. Together, there is one security person for about every 4,500 Nigerians. The UN standard is one security person, roughly, for every 500 citizens. So that, if you like, Nigeria is under-policed in comparison with the UN standards. But it goes deeper than that. Many, perhaps most, Nigerians avoid any contact with the police or the army if they possibly can. There is plenty of anecdotal evidence that in the Northeast, people are as afraid of the security services as they are of Boko Haram. It is, I think, symbolic, if nothing else, that in 2011, when Boko Haram emerged as an active terrorist organization, one of its earliest targets was the National Police Headquarters in Abuja, the Louis Edit Center. But perhaps even more fundamentally and more generally, the Nigerian government is largely and increasingly alienated from the Nigerian people. The reasons for this are complex, and they are predominantly historical. It starts with the fact that Nigeria is an artificial creation by the British, largely for their own bureaucratic convenience, in which they lumped together some 350 radically different ethnic groups into a single entity, largely for convenience of administration. Further, unlike in other African countries, such as Algeria or Kenya, the independence movement in Nigeria never broke out of ethnic straitjackets. In other words, there was a Yoruba independence movement, an Igbo independence movement, and so forth. But the as it were, fathers of Nigerian independence were mostly against colonialism, against racism, but without a clear vision of what a united Nigeria would be. And of course, independence was followed by civil war and then a generation of military rule, which further isolated the government from the people. Nigerians will often say to you that the country remains essentially a colonial entity, that the only difference is the British have been replaced by indigenous elites. Finally, just a few very specific comments, or more specific comments, about Boko Haram and the jihadi movements in the north. Some issues that that I find quite intriguing and have no answers to. The first is that having survived for a decade, Boko Haram and other jihadi groups clearly must have some popular support, but how much is very hard to know. It draws on the Islamic revival in the north, but even if active support for Boko Haram is only 5% of the north's population, that would still be 5 million people, which means that there are plenty of people for Boko Haram to recruit from. Second point, the relationship between Boko Haram, the Islamic State, and Al-Qaeda are very much debatable. To my mind, the resilience that Boko Haram shows would imply that it is predominantly an indigenous movement rather than one that is fueled from the outside. And finally, government policy, which is essentially the hammer, has, I think, been a failure, but the government is involved in no other approach at present. You put all this together, and it's hard to resist the conclusion that the jihadist insurgency will continue indefinitely in one form or another. Thanks very much.
Well, thank you, Ambassador, for those extraordinarily rich, comprehensive, and at the same time, pithy comments. Much to explore there. Dr. Suifon, if I can turn to you to follow up where Ambassador Campbell just left off, to hone in on the Northeast. If you can please give us a picture of the difficult security situation and its humanitarian dimensions. I would really like to thank Ambassador Campbell for bringing in the issue of pandemic and tropical forest destruction in Nigeria. And also I would raise the issue of wild meat consumption in Nigeria, something that frequently receives very little to no attention, yet it's very complex, both with respect to the need to assure livelihoods of local people, but also prevent catastrophic global effects. Dr. Suifon, away from the tropical forest to the forest of Sambisa and the Northwest, what's happening with security there?
Good afternoon, Vanda, and thank you very much for this opportunity. Sorry for the little hitch. I know that I have 5 minutes, and the story of the Northeast can take a whole day, but I will be very snappy to just say that from where Ambassador Campbell has ended, that the Northeast has become a very challenging part of the country and is no longer the Northeast, as you have rightly said, because it looks like the Kankagom that hit the Northeast is shifting to other parts of the country. And in the Northeast, for 11 years, the country has been grappling with an insurgency whose drivers and roots are deep into many of the societal issues that we can think about. We have economic drivers to this crisis. We have social crisis drivers. We do have sociocultural drivers. We have religious drivers to this and dimensions of security. And that begins to define what Boko Haram is all about. When people have been talking, usually I always want to share this, that my knowledge initially was focusing more only on a jihadist group. But having stayed in Nigeria for now, you can rightly talk of an opportunistic Boko Haram. You talk of a criminal Boko Haram. You can talk of political Boko Haram if you want to. You talk of a religious Boko Haram. And it's like a confluence of a group and interest that are then capitalizing on the weaknesses that are already in society and then perpetuating itself for 11 years. The humanitarian situation is still very huge. I was part of the Northeast Recovery and Peace Building Assessment that was jointly undertaken by the United Nations and the European Union and the World Bank. And it came out with a very interesting revelations, which I will not belabor here because I've already highlighted. We show in this PowerPoint so people can pick after this. But we still have a huge population displaced. More than 11 years, people have been internally displaced in their own country. And it's very, very hurtful. Of course, tens of thousands in neighboring countries, Niger and Cameroon, grappling with their own issues, but yes, also hosting a good number of refugees that moved into those countries because of the Boko Haram insurgency. We're also talking about a displacement map, which I want to share with you from my screen. But before we go there, you could see that this map of underdevelopment and inequalities is very revealing. And we cannot have time to discuss all this, but just to tell you that the economic indicators in the Northeast before the outbreak of this crisis were very poor. This could have been one of the poorest parts of the country. But I also want to nuance it by saying that some reports are showing that the Northwest was almost worse than the Northeast in terms. That means we are talking about a region that is vulnerable. And if the justification of the insurgency in the Northeast is because of the deep poverty, development deficit that we're all talking about, then we have every reason to be worried that the Northwest, if the ongoing banditry act, which of course we are just lacking a word to say banditry, because when you see a group of 200 or 100 people in motorbikes, in AK-47s, invade a village and ransack it and go without, I don't think we can call that bandit. It's something that we don't have a name for it now, but it is pinpointed to something more serious than this. Of course, activities of kidnapping for ransom have all held the country hostage. I've talked about the major drivers, as I mentioned a while ago, and I will not belabor on that because they are all here, I will share. But again, I want to share another map, just to let you know one of the problems I'm talking about, the environmental driver. The Lake Chad, which the waters lost its size, almost a shadow of itself over the years, has been also regarded as one of the drivers that has pushed a lot of other things to befall that particular region, including criminality, lack of agriculture, extensive work, which was facilitated by huge irrigation farmings that took place in that part of the country when the lake was in its full state. We are now also talking about pasture land that has become more and more scarce. And then cattle breeders are moving southwards and aggravating the farmers' herders crisis that we've talked about, which of course is very predominant in the Northwest, North Central, and not the Middle Belt part of the country. In 2018, it was so difficult that deaths from farmer herders crisis almost overshadowed deaths from Boko Haram insurgency. If I can go again, I could show you another map of the conflict map and displacement. The map was done in 2016, but when I looked at the current dynamics, it has barely changed. is all the key issues are still there. People are still internally displaced, and we are having secondary and tertiary displacements. People have been in refugee camps hoping that they were about to settle, and there was already talk whether they could be settled even in the semi-urban areas pending final liberation of the territories or making it more safe for habitation. Then there were attacks and so on and so forth. We have also learned of attempts by the North, the Borno State governor, to settle the population because he believes that IDPs have become a perpetual issue. But we seem to have been looking only at the surface without addressing the roots, why it is that way. And I think that's the type of discussion we need to talk about. I have figures here, statistics from OCHA, giving us a number of people not only displaced, more than 1.9, but also people in need of nutrition assistance. And we already know what just happened last 2 weeks in Borno state again, where the Zabarmani Mari farm community in the Jere local government area was attacked, and groups slaughtered human beings like fowls in their numbers. Of course, there was a problem of what is the exact number, but that's not the issue. People were slaughtered in broad daylight, and the people abandoned the farms. And so when we talk of food shortage in the Northeast, it's not because there's no food at all, but because people cannot even go to the farms. So you have these statistics, also displacement, people who have returned, yet you still have a huge number that is still not settled yet. Of course, all these have been compounded, Vanda, before my 5 minutes are almost up now, because of the COVID-19 pandemic. And I must say that when you have few numbers of COVID in that part, you have a sizable number coming up in Borno because humanitarian workers and the rest of the people are encouraged to do testing before any other thing. But small numbers do not in any way reflect the total reality because there is almost very little testing. And so we cannot know how many the casualties of these. We're just happy that the pandemic has not been very, very, very deadly in Nigeria as anticipated by analysts. So you could see the map. You look at the map of COVID in Nigeria. You see the north is almost looking like, oh, there's no COVID in the Northeast. But the areas where you have numbers showing is the fact that there have been lots of testings in those areas. I will stop here and follow up, Netaro. Thank you so much, Vanda.
Excellent. Thank you, Takwa, so much for the very useful review and particularly highlighting how dire and difficult both the security and humanitarian situations continue to be in the Northeast and spread. Before I hand it over to Sophia, let me make a few remarks about the reasons why the security situation remains so difficult. And I'm really reflecting in very few brief comments, two reports of mine, one called Militias and Militancy in Northeast Nigeria, Not Going Away, that came out this year in 2020, and a prior report of 2018 called In Nigeria, We Don't Want Them Back. What really we have been seeing is a fundamental difficulty for the Nigerian military of holding areas that are nominally cleared of Boko Haram, particularly in the 2015-2016 period, after years of the Nigerian government having a very lukewarm and minimal response to the critical situation in the north, significant amount of clearing operations were in fact mounted and often involved international cooperation, particularly from the Lake Chad area, but also to some extent beyond. And nonetheless, many of these clearing operations essentially consisted of the Nigerian security services, particularly the military hauling off entire cleared villages into detentions, sometimes into so-called black prisons where people may be languishing still today, years later, other times in prolonged detention. There were many reasons why this strategy took place, but at the core is the problem still today, the inability to effectively hold the cleared areas, let alone build them up. Now, this has become quite compounded since 2017 because of several developments, the most important of which is the split off of a branch of Boko Haram that now calls itself the Islamic State in West Africa province, which formally is also the name of the group that we often think of as Boko Haram, led by Shekau. But the Islamic State in West Africa province, based particularly in the like Chad area, has been both very effective in terms of battlefield learning to some extent from ISIS units and members in other parts of Africa, such as Libya, but also much more focused on building political capital among local populations. And building political capital by delivering at least minimal services. During my trips to the Northeast, I would hear of women being escorted by ISWAP to hospitals to give birth, something that neither the government nor anyone else provided them. And this is in contrast to the brutality of Boko Haram, the original faction that chose to rule essentially solely through plunder and brutality, often imposing very significant hardships on populations. And so ISWAP was able to overrun a set of military bases, including some very important military bases. And the Nigerian military then shrunk into a posture that's known as the supercamp strategy, which essentially minimizes the presence of military units out among the population. But because as a result, the Nigerian military is not able to provide security, it has often also forced local populations to collapse onto the camp as well. That creates many problems, one of which is the inability to secure territory, another one which is the inability to provide livelihoods, as people can go out and cultivate often only very short crops, short so that the insurgents are presumably not allowed to hide in the crops and really not able to obtain livelihoods because they are not allowed to go beyond 5 kilometers or 3 kilometers beyond the super camp. Combined with this is the fact that all along since 2000, since 9, but particularly since about 2012 and continually since, the Nigerian military has extensively relied on the use of militias. In the Northeast, there are many of the groups, one of which is the so-called Civilian Joint Task Force, itself composed of very many groups. They are really at the forefront of operations. They are often the cannon fodder. They are both the first line of defense so that when ISWAP or Boko Haram attacks, they suffer casualties. They are at the lead of offensive operations, both because they perhaps sometimes know the local ground, but also once again, because they are used to bear the brunt of casualties. At the same time, they have been appropriated by politicians in the north for a whole variety of purposes, such as getting votes beyond the insurgency. But we have to also appreciate that Northeast governors and increasingly Northwest governors see the militias as the only element they can control, otherwise having to beg Abuja to deliver either federal police forces or soldiers, and both often engaged in a bargaining relationship with state governors to have discretionary fund of state governors to pay for federal police and military units. And this is indeed emblematic of the massive security issues across the country, where state governors do not have control of forces, are in this complex bargaining relationship over the use of discretionary funds, and thus prefer to create militias like the Bakassi Boys in the South, a whole variety of new militias meant to deal with the farmers-herders conflict, also present as far as Lagos, Edo, and other parts of the country that nonetheless come to create an own severe security challenge. And these dynamics are then overlaid in the Northwest, both as Boko Haram and ISWAP have expanded there, the banditry, cattle rustling, criminal groups that operate there, and the intense farmers-herders conflict, dormant perhaps, or partially addressed perhaps, as it is right now. I'll leave it at that and turn to you, Ms. Michaels, please, to give us a sense from the ground of what is it like to live in this situation for local people. How are they appreciating, prioritizing, identifying threats to them? What are priority issues, and how can the how is the humanitarian community responding in this challenge? And just one other comment here: we talk about the crisis in the Northwest. We should appreciate that essentially the entire international humanitarian assistance is centered on the Northeast, where the needs are still massive. But there is almost no international presence in the Northwest with respect to humanitarian issues. Sophia, over to you, please.
Thank you, Dr. Vanda. Of course, it is general knowledge, as Stefan has already reiterated, in terms of the condition in the Northeast and over a decade of the security challenges, the insurgency has made infrastructure inaccessible by the IDPs. And also it has continued to be a potential threat to also humanitarian actors as well as IDPs, who are also not only living in the deep field, but also in the heart of Maiduguri, which also makes it quite difficult to travel beyond 10 to 15 kilometers outside the city and return safely. Of course, as Stefan mentioned, the example is the recent killing of the farmers in the Zabarmari Koshobe attack that also followed 3 days after, which presented a very difficult situation while the government was trying to also present assistance to the people of the area. Of course, as he mentioned, also traveling to Bama and other parts of the Lake Chad regions is almost difficult, except with the support or use of the United Nations Humanitarian Air Services. Quite a number of IDPs are still left in the camp, as well as those who have to try to return back to their bases. It's still difficult for them to be able to also survive in the respective return areas of origin, because the key issues and key concerns by IDPs and other host communities also includes the provisions of basic communities like shelter, like food, security and livelihoods, which has necessitated the humanitarian actors to have to change the method or strategy of response to a more dignified way of assistance to the cash-based transfer, which of course that, as we know recently, has proven more and more difficult by more of the policies or more agencies that have been put up that are managing the humanitarian organizations in terms of movement of cash by federal government agencies, where you have to secure clearance before you are also able to move either cargo or assistance to also the deep field locations. So access has also become a very, very key concern to both the humanitarian actors and also by the IDPs, exacerbating also, of course, medical services that is provided. Protection issues and concerns have become more of concern. Gender-based violence has become more rising concern, not only related to sexual exploitation or abuse or sexual abuse, but more in terms of course, what is prevalent in the North, the early girl child marriage that is related to that, and also to be able to provide dignity kits by humanitarian actors to displaced communities in the deep field locations has become more and more difficult because of the breakup of the factions of the Boko Haram, which are now factioned into the ISWAP, and also the Jais with more criminal bands that have come up also, making it more difficult to travel along the roads because of the conditions of the road, as well as securing clearance by military to be able to send in assistance in terms of cargo clearance. And sometimes also because of the security situation where IDPs are in need of assistance because they are lacking the basic necessities of food, shelter, water, you know. So they have to also relocate sometimes without waiting for assistance to get to them to other locations where there is supposed to be assistance provided, where it's more accessible, where we see a new trend in displacement, where people are moving voluntarily or involuntarily because of security situation and condition, despite the efforts by the humanitarian actors and the state government to try to provide assistance. So access has become more and more an issue, both to the IDPs and to the humanitarian communities to be able to provide assistance to the basic necessities. Also, another issue is the congestion, of course, in the camps that has become more and more concerned, especially with the onset of the COVID-19 to already existing the dilapidated infrastructure in the camps and in the host communities. Of course, these are more and more of the key concerns of people living on the ground and the inability to travel far away from the city to be able to make some sort of living by farming. It has become more and more difficult, despite the support by military to try to provide assistance. And of course, there has been efforts by the state government in collaboration with some of the humanitarian actors or the humanitarian community to return, because the concerns by IDPs is they want to return, but they also want to return to a secured environment, not just to return to where they will be attacked eventually within a short period of time. So the state government itself is also like cutting between the devil and the deep blue sea, if I will say, in trying to make sure that they are able to provide the basic necessities they say they provide, which is sometimes the barest, looking at the returns and relocation of IDPs to places like Ngoshe, that is around the Goza axis. And it's only the barest services that is provided in terms of few medical assistance, which the government does not really have much of the capacity to do that. And the humanitarian actors that are supposed to be supporting to do that are really facing a lot of challenges in terms of access. So that has become more and more difficult for the IDPs, both within Maiduguri, outside Maiduguri, and also in terms of traveling along the roads that by both the humanitarian actors itself without military escort, it is almost impossible to travel because of the road plans at IEDs, a lot of rise in the abduction and kidnapping with a ransom demand that is cutting across Burma along the Sambisa forest axis, where you cannot travel even between Pulka and Goza without a military escort, because the factions have dismantled and formed small gangs that has become more banditry along the road. So it's become more and more difficult for IDPs and for humanitarian actors on the ground in the Northeast.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Sophia, for this enormously useful portrait from the ground to give us a real feel of what life is like. Some of us have been fortunate to go to places like Maiduguri, but for many of the communities, Maiduguri is as far away and as cut off as perhaps Maiduguri might be for us from the United States. So enormously important insights from you and the work you're doing. Dr. O'Neill, let me turn to you. I spoke about the challenges of policy, so has Ambassador Campbell, about the real deficiencies in the military strategy. Are there alternatives how to reduce or mitigate the conflict, such as by encouraging exits of individuals, defectors programs like Operation Safe Corridor that exists in the Northeast and is meant to channel low-risk defectors out of the insurgencies? Your insight, please.
Thank you, Vanda, and thank you to Brookings for inviting me to be part of such a great group and what a wonderful panel. Yes, so there are alternatives, and I'll tell you a little bit, just 30 seconds or so, about our project and then some of the early findings related to exactly the question you've just posed. So one of the things we don't really understand, despite having supported these types of interventions for a long time, is exactly sort of what it means, the lived experience of exiting an armed group or an armed force, and what types of interventions really support those kind of full and permanent transitions out of armed groups. So when military solutions aren't necessarily the right option or the only option, when we're talking about widespread involvement in many of these conflicts, how do you help people exit a conflict and return to civilian life in a productive way? This project is, it really tries to bring together both robust research and practitioners. So we work with IOM, UNICEF, UNDP, DPO, and the World Bank as our partners. And we've got great support from Norway, the UK, Switzerland, and Ireland. So we're bringing together a really diverse community to try to do this together. The goal is to try to collect really quality and comparable data over a long period of time. Part of the problem is any of the assessments we have in this space are these snapshots. And we really think that when you exit a conflict, when you exit an armed group or an armed force, it's a process of disengaging both probably mentally with your identity, but also from a network, and to stop certain conflict-related behaviors and support functions. And that takes a while. When we're talking about terrorist context, there's not a lot of acceptance that this is not a cold turkey or a sudden event, that it takes a while, but we indeed believe that the evidence suggests that that's the case. We've spent a year putting together a converging vision for what this sort of looks like, how you would study it, and what kind of tools you would use. And we've developed a bunch of these tools. And we're now pilot testing them in multi-year studies in two countries, including Nigeria and the Northeast. So in Nigeria, we're looking at people coming out of Boko Haram, ISWAP, and SARO, and the CJTF. We're doing this sort of overlaid on top of a series of UN-supported programs meant to support those transitions, to better understand what works and under which conditions. But we're also looking at the community. We recognize that exits are not a one-way street. It requires an acceptance by the community on the other side. And these are communities that have been heavily victimized. So we're doing a series of community-oriented studies with community leaders and community members so we can contextualize those transitions. So we're running three surveys right now in these like last couple weeks, and I have some initial results, just sort of inklings of what's coming out of one of our community leader surveys. So I have about 100 respondents so far, so not a very big sample, but at least gives you some interesting little tidbits. And I think one of the things that's so important, and it comes back to Vanda's question about are there alternatives? One of the things we're seeing, and this is not sort of groundbreaking for most people who study this conflict, is how widespread association the conflict is. I mean, how many people in the community have been involved with Boko Haram in some way, shape, or form? So of the community leaders that we've surveyed, the majority of them have large numbers in their communities who've been associated in some way, shape, or form, whether abducted or willing. There's also a pretty sizable number of people who have been involved willingly. This echoes, even though this is an emerging finding, this echoes work in space before. So some great work in 2019 by Rebecca Lippman, Graham Blair, and Rebecca Wolf with Mercy Corps, where they found 8% of a random sample in and around Maiduguri said that they had been involved with Boko Haram. And these are talking to people that they'd never met before and admitting this. So that's a pretty high number, and I think quite important. But it's important for us not to focus only on Boko Haram. I think one of the things here that's really important in looking at Borno is the large scale mobilization into these self-defense forces that Vanda was mentioning just a moment ago. So these various forces, the CJTF, other types of Yangora, hunters and charmers who are performing these functions, they are predominantly the main security provider in many communities. So like 80%, 86% of the leaders we talked to identified the CJTF as one of the main security providers. So not the military, not the police. And many of these organizations started on their own. They are sort of ad hoc. So they're not necessarily under a lot of guidance or adhering to as many rules or have as much oversight per se. So that creates sort of a difficult situation for moving forward. If you look at the involvement levels, nearly 60% of all communities that we're looking at have really high CJTF involvement from the community. And that's not even some of the other types of even more loosely organized groups as well. I think this is really important because in addition to relying on these groups very heavily for their security, there's also an emerging concern about them. So 20% of the community leaders that we interviewed identified the CJTF and some of these groups as the primary threat against their community. So that raises some questions. I think another one is, you know, a majority of the people that we've interviewed thus far said they're really concerned about what happens when you demobilize some of these CJTF, you right-size some of these CJTF groups, what those people who've been let go about and do. So this is something I think we have to worry about, not only on the Boko Haram side and how do you help people exit an organization like that, but also how do you deal with this very ad hoc community-driven response, which has been, I think, very important for communities, but also potentially raises some challenges and concerns, I think, long-term about security and obviously adherence to human rights and certain standards of policing, things like that. So that's one sort of thing just to highlight the how large spread this is. The other one, and I'll just quickly get to it, is the role of climate change in facilitating this crisis. So my colleagues, Adam Day and Jessica Kauss, have done some great work on climate security and did a case study in Nigeria that highlighted the role of climate change in sort of facilitating conflict. And that's what we're hearing again about the conversation around the Northwest. Of the community leaders that we've interviewed, overwhelmingly, they know people whose livelihoods have been damaged because of climate-related change. And of those, 37% say they know someone who joined Boko Haram specifically because of a climate-related livelihood challenge. 61% said they know someone who joined the CJTF, Yangor, or other self-defense group because of a climate-related livelihood issue. So this, given sort of all the emphasis on the Northwest and the Middle Belt, is extremely important for us to think about prevention for recruitment into these types of armed groups. So I'll stop there. I know I probably hit my time.
Thank you, Shaban. This is a perfect transition to both some of the questions that are coming in the that are coming in, the written questions. Please continue submitting them. And it's also a great transition for us now to do a lightning round. 3 minutes, please, if we can, on what are the policy recommendations. And let me highlight some of the questions that have come in that are highly pertinent for the policy recommendations and for the issues that we are dealing. Shaban, you spoke about DDR, bringing not just Boko Haram actors, but also militias out. What is the track record of such programs in Nigeria broadly, in the Northeast? What is the role of alternative livelihoods? How can they be created? We're getting those questions both about the Northeast and Northwest related to farmers' herders conflict. Ambassador Campbell, some of the questions have to do with security sector reform in Nigeria. Should governors have power over state police? Should there be state police? Should there be devolution of state policing? And anyone, perhaps Dr. Suifun, reflection on so-called community policing efforts in Nigeria, what do they mean in practice? Another related set of questions on that is coming in and that is related to policy recommendations, the role of community dialogue and community reconciliations, as well as finally more issues of how to deal with gender-specific policy. Women who are associated or seen as associated with either Boko Haram or other groups. And maybe, Sophia, if I can put you on the spot, there is a big debate with respect to whether there should be efforts to encourage women in the Northwest as well as Northeast, widows or women who were raped to marry and remarry or marry, and whether this should be facilitated by perhaps financial incentives, because it is often men who are key providers of security. That policy is often advocated by Nigerian NGOs and deeply disliked in the international humanitarian response that wants to provide livelihoods but doesn't want to encourage marriage. So any reflections on this dilemma and or how to deal with gender issues, and any other related policy recommendations at both the level of Abuja as well as very local policy responses. Ambassador Campbell, if I can start with you, please.
Thank you very much. Security sector reform, with a particular focus on the police, it's a knotty problem. The National Police were established by the British, in part bearing in mind that the country is divided into literally hundreds of ethnic groups. And the concern was that if policing were local, then the dominant ethnic group would dominate the police and would essentially make nearly impossible justice for various minorities. I would suggest that that this concern continues. And in fact, the morselization of Nigeria from essentially three regions at the time of independence into 36 states plus Abuja, with regular calls for even more states, means that more and more states are dominated by a particular ethnic group. What concerns me is if you have a state police under the control of a governor, are you then moving towards warlordism, particularly as the national government continues to decline in effectiveness? I'm not saying that this question is easy. I would start with security sector reform of the police with practical and concrete steps, such as raising police salaries, paying salaries on time, so that policemen are not manning checkpoints essentially to shake down people passing through them, simply to keep their own bodies and souls together.
Excellent. Thank you very much. And thank you for being so timely. Dr. Suifon, please, to you, what are the key policy recommendations in this very big set of policy dimensions that I put on the table and that have come in the questions?
Thank you very much, Vanda. I think I will dwell most on this issue of community policing, and just to situate it in a context. In 2014, there was a national conference in Nigeria during the government of President Jonathan that debated on so many issues. And the discussion that lasted for close to 4 months touched on almost every topical issue you can think about, including policing, including most of the issues that are cropping up today. Unfortunately, the findings of this conference were shoved aside by the incoming government, and that's one of the issues that we are looking forward to seeing how we can break from this, where governments come, flag issues, and then the next government comes and puts them aside and continue with their own. That notwithstanding, there has been a continuous clamor for restructuring in the country. And this word too is also as vague as you may think, because everybody means something else when they talk of restructuring. That means I have my own views when I'm talking about restructuring. That means when you're in the Southwest, the people in the Southeast, they mean something different from those in the Northeast, and so on and so forth. And the ambassador has highlighted the issue, the sensitive nature of ethnicity and religions in Nigeria. So any attempt to change the status quo, there's a feeling that we are capacitating a particular group or so on and so on and so forth. So I think the trust deficit is so huge that even genuine attempts to do whatever reforms on board, people are suspicious of it. There's an ongoing constitutional reform, and more there has been an echo which is almost gaining momentum, or that there's need for devolving of powers or community policing. But we have not, there's no agreement yet on what specifically it should be. And you will know that the insecurity had pushed people to start beyond the vigilante, which may look like ad hoc. People are going into formal structures. And that is what saw the emergence of the Amotekun security outfit from the Southwest. And they took it from a regional perspective, which again sent some signals. People were like, well, we thought it was a state level. A region talking about its regional outfit. What is on the menu? What is in the offing? So there were doubts, there were suspicions, and so on and so forth. But I think that this community policing should go with something else. So begin to look at some of the roots, the drivers of this crisis, because it is not just a security issue alone. And we are all saying that security measures alone will not address the magnitude of crisis in Nigeria. What are the other issues that we need to think about? What are the, and the governor of the Borno State said the other day that more than 25 years, there has been no repair of any federal route in Borno, and there had been no construction of any new route in Borno. That is very revealing. And he was very categorical, saying that if there were route structures and infrastructure, Boko Haram insurgency would have been reduced by 60%. And I think that without being emotional, people should begin to look at that direction to say, what are the other non-kinetic measures that we need to be addressing, doing to address the issues that are bedeviling not only the Northeast, but that are also, that is now also going to other parts of the country. So the trust deficit and the issues of peace, the issues of justice, and the issues of inclusivity, as articulated in SDG 16, become for some of us the central issue that we should discuss. You can't talk about this police when people fear that people will use police against other groups, just as it has been articulated. What then should be done? SDG 16 about justice, peace, and inclusive inclusion is trying to frame it. But in the Nigerian context, what does that mean? I think these are still some of the issues that we are struggling to deal with. And we've been advocating for peace structures at community, at state, and if possible, regional level. And when people begin to talk, when people begin to dialogue, we believe that the trust deficit will begin to narrow. And we have to begin somewhere. And there are moves already, like the recommendations that we are part of, parcel of the recovery and peace assessment in the Northeast to begin to set structures. But it looks like, because we are dealing with a crisis that is still almost coming to the limelight, and that is putting the government at a very difficult situation, because the narrative has been Boko Haram has been technically defeated, Boko Haram has been finished, they can no longer regroup, they can no longer hold ground. But I don't think that we should define defeating Boko Haram by not holding ground. I think we are saying that this is an asymmetrical war, and that using military strategies alone will not resolve it. Thank you.
Well, thank you for those very important comments. Let me quickly check that perhaps at a very broad level, but also a fundamental level, a key issue is one of far greater accountability. Whether it's security sector reform or development policies, the reality is, of course, that very many actors, not just militant groups or so-called bandits, perpetrate grave, severe human rights abuses, extrajudicial killings, and that many an investigation is sometimes conducted, yet always shoved under the rug into the drawer. Investigations are rarely transparent, rarely advertise what was actually found. And more importantly, there is very sporadic accountability of perpetrators, whether they are members of the military, members of police, not just SARS, but broader police forces, or for that matter, politicians, governors, government members who are guilty of corruption. And this poses this fundamental lack of accountability, the ability to get away with crime, corruption, and literally murder under the cover and rubric of state action, of course, means that policies such as DDR, rolling militia groups into state forces, into federal police or military forces, are troubled to the extent that they want to come into those forces at all, which they very frequently don't. Many members of CJPF do not want to join either the federal police or the Nigerian military because they don't want to be deployed away from the north. But to the extent that they come in at all, if they come in with the same dirty, abusive practices they engage with prior, or if the setting is of abuse, then that problem is merely perpetuated. And alternative livelihoods are great, all the power to them. The reality is that what's being delivered is alternative jobs training rather than alternative livelihoods. In the context where perhaps 75% of people live in poverty and very high number, well over 50%, do not have access to jobs. That unemployment is very hard. So people are trained in making shoes and sewing clothes, perhaps in being electrician, but without really having an economy into which they can join outside of the military sector. So the security sector reform is naughty. So are other policy dimensions. Ms. Michael, what about healing, community dialogues, reconciliation among different ethnic groups, among different religious groups? What is the state of these efforts and how effective can they be?
Thank you very much, Vanda. I think that at the core of interventions, especially in the Northeast, lies dialogue, especially between community IDPs as well as community leaders, and because there is a feeling of in some displaced communities or most displaced communities of the fact that one of the concerns that some of them express or some of the anger that they express is, I know you were part of people who impacted on my family or that resulted in the displacement. So there is a blame approach or perspective that is also very key, that we have to go in the way of dialogue, reconciliation, for us to arrive at healing, because healing cannot be attained just in isolation without dialogue. And one of some of the interventions that have been done by, of course, some of the humanitarian actors, of course, it involves a larger to a large degree, I will say, conflict dispute resolutions, perspective, also empowering the community leaders, the religious leaders, in terms of having knowledge and skills of dialogue, of resolving conflict within the communities, within the IDPs, within the host communities and within the camps as well. And there is also intensified efforts to ensure that there is no isolation of particular ethnic groups or particular persons from a particular community living in within a camp or within a host community, segregated from another faction of the community, or a camp or a host community that is strictly based on a particular ethnic group. So those kind of efforts and the empowerment of the community leaders, the religious leaders, to be able to take more fully and document and record and be able to have dispute resolve, also in terms of returns and to see how far it can go, is a sure way of taking it forward to healing. But there is a lot more that needs to be done in the aspect of how far can the healing go, because there is more need for psychosocial support, there is more need for psychological awareness, sensitization, and to give people the time to be able to heal, because it's not going to happen in one day, it's not going to happen in 2 days, it's going to take years for healing to return. And one of the ways to get that also, to start running also, is to also intensify and see towards the effort of having people return back to their state of their home of origin, because that will help when people get more sustainably involved in finding livelihoods and being able to interact and integrate and kind of from day to day kind of interact more and more with the communities. I think the healing will happen going that way. And maybe a forum that is put up to see how people will be able to air grievances, not necessarily only because it is tied to a conflict, but also because, oh, this is how I feel towards you. This is how my perspective towards this community is, or towards the community leaders as well. What role are they playing in terms of segregation or bias? I think that will go a long way in the healing, in also in more and more of the psychological support interventions that needs to be seen in the humanitarian interventions. This is difficult to actually access because it's cost intensive, of course, when you have to compare what are the basic needs of the displaced communities or host communities right now as against the emotional state of people. The first priority will always come to be that you need to provide the basic infrastructure, you need to provide the basic amenities, you need to provide food and shelter. And so it is a struggle to have that included, even though it is mainstream in some of the humanitarian interventions. But I think a lot more needs to be done in that aspect, in that regard, which also needs to involve a lot more of women in that participation, because women need to be more trained, women need to be more empowered to be able to do that, because they have that ability to be able to facilitate reconciliation, to be able to facilitate that the engagement, to be the cross bridge between that emotional healing process and the forgiveness process, because it plays a very pivotal role in the journey towards healing. So I think a lot more needs to be done, a lot more funding and needs to be also focused in terms of that aspect of the healing process that is related to psychological support interventions for people in terms of providing support for returns to places of origin in terms of resuscitation of livelihoods as well.
Thank you, Shaban, to you. Key recommendations from your perspective, perhaps on issues that we haven't touched yet on, if there are any such you would like to take on.
Well, I'll respond a little bit to some of the questions because I think they have recommendations kind of built in. And one is the question about, you know, do we know anything about sort of the impact of the kind of DDR process that's like processes that are in Nigeria? And the truth is we don't really know a lot yet about their impact. And I think that's the reason for this project, but this isn't a Nigeria specific issue. I mean, across the board, DDR and other types of reintegration interventions are humanitarian interventions. Given the timeline, the time frame, and the rush to get support for people, you know, this kind of evaluation, this really robust assessment hasn't existed. And we really just haven't taken the time because of funding cycles and other challenges to really follow people, to really understand what works and what doesn't. So we don't really know now, and that's what we're hoping to contribute to and to assist you and partners with, but we don't really know in a lot of places. So I think this is really important. It speaks to a recommendation, which is we need a lot more robust assessment here. So we know what works, we know what doesn't. We have a number of very large scale conflicts with a lot of different groups that would overwhelm the criminal justice systems if they all went through that process. And so you're going to need some sort of alternate approach, whether it's some sort of transitional justice approach, some sort of DDR program. And we really need to know if these things work and under which conditions. You know, where should we prioritizing our limited resources for programming? And that gets me to livelihoods, the question you asked, Vanda. Yeah, very good point about there's a lot of jobs training, but not necessarily a lot of jobs waiting for people that come out of them. And livelihoods are important. People need to have an income stream, but I think we've focused on them really narrowly and not necessarily on sort of what they might represent. First of all, we don't know if they're the reason people leave or the reason they stay out or just an indication that they've stayed out, right? We don't know if it's about just having income, so supplementing income or replacing income that an armed group was providing, or if it's more about the status and other things that a job or employment can provide. So there's a lot there that we're trying to unpack with really sort of nuanced economic studies. So I think that's really important. But I think the main thing to remember in policy considerations around all of this is how individualized these paths into armed groups are and how individualized they are out. And so I think it's important to remember undoing the reason someone went in does not mean they come out, right? The reason they went is and not the reason they stay in. It's not the reason that they go back. So I think really understanding the totality of experience for individuals is important. I'll just make one last comment on women. And I think this, again, has a lot of programmatic implications. So this is a very difficult population to identify. These are many women kind of go back to their communities and try to self-reintegrate, to lay low because of stigma and other issues. And so it's really hard to get access to them, to identify them and get access to them, to find out sort of their programming preferences and how they could be reached without doing harm. And we know that programming tends not to be as gender sensitive as it should be. And particularly around girls and women who may have been married to a Boko Haram fighter or have children from a Boko Haram fighter, you need to make sure that this programming is really flexible because they will have very different preferences coming out and those preferences will likely change over time. So we need to have an adaptive structure that can change and respond to those needs. And we're seeing that in other countries as well. So I'll just stop there.
Thanks very much, Yvonne. Let me, we have about 10 minutes. Let me bundle a whole set of questions that have come in on farmers-herders conflict. That have to also ask what is a better way to deal with them. Is the manned peace deal, a model for how to deal with farmers, herders? What about the Zamfara deal of several years ago? What should it tell us about how viable the deals that were struck this year and last year are? What is the role of the international community in dealing with desertification in the Lake Chad area? And what role can the international community have in addressing farmers herders conflict and its reverberations across the country? Please perhaps just unmute yourself if you would like to come in on that issue. Sophie, I know that you wanted to come in. Send me a note in the chat or unmute anyone else if you would like to come in. Sophia, please.
Thank you, Vanda. I think that one of the crux that we need to look at when we come to the farmer headers issue is understanding that this is fueled by continued insecurity across African countries. Which has continuously made the nomadic Fulani, well, as a result of nomadic Fulani, who usually follow the seasons, you know, to the movement and all that, in search of pastoral crops for their farmers. But I really think that the result of the conflict between the herders and the farmers and the seeking for compensation has a lot also to do with the corruption within the judicial system, also in the delivery of the judgment, as well as failure of the government to be able to address the issue of grazing, which has continued to remain a major challenge that also has led to escalation of conflicts and has also led to the loss of lives and destruction of properties, especially in the situations around the southern Kaduna areas and the Plateau Benue axis. Well, to mention but a few. But I think that one of the key issues that we need to look at is how is the judicial system approaching the farmers headers conflict, and is it objective or it is subjective? Is it transparent? How do we go about it? How does government need to look into how the judicial system is also addressing this particular aspect of it? Because without this first being addressed at the judicial system, I don't really see much to be done from it, because it's just going to continue to escalate without us addressing from the core when we have to address it as from a judicial perspective, and without a government backing or without a law and a reform that addresses it from a judicial perspective.
Thank you. That's indeed one of the issues, isn't it? That these peace deals are struck, whether it's with MEND or the Zamfara deal of 2014, yet there is or the current deals, yet there is essentially no enforcement mechanism. So groups that stay and participate in the deal, great, but others who violate, whether they are militias or the very same actors, are not held accountable. And this then creates perception, of course, that the best way to milk deals and jobs and payoffs is by creating insecurity and raising arms. Takwa or John. John, I see that you unmuted. Would you like to come in on the farmers herders issue?
Yes, thank you very much. An important dimension of the conflict, I think, is its exploitation by various political figures to advance their own agendas. Their ability to do so is a reflection of the weakening of the Nigerian federal government. With farmer herder, as with so many other conflicts in Nigeria, you have to start with governance and the improvement of governance. As for we outsiders, we very often know very little, but we are quick to jump to conclusions. Hence, our media is too often prepared to take a farmer-herder conflict and put it into particularly a religious context, Christian versus Muslims, and not only is that false, but it actually makes the situation worse.
Thank you. Very important. Shaban or Takwa, would you like to come in perhaps on the issue of how the international community can help address desertification in Lake Chad, in Sahel more broadly? And I would, of course, highlight that there are echoes or very similar manifestations in other parts of Africa with the Laikipia invasions in Kenya and the issues of the herders invading national parks, protected areas, as well as farming land in Kenya and East Africa several years ago as a result of overgrazing and climate change and desertification and loss of pasture. So Africa-wide problem that will only get more intense.
Thank you very much, Vanda. If I may just use the words of the president, President Buhari, when the UN team visited once, he said, cows will not stop anywhere until when they see water. He said the issue of water points is very critical in containing the movement of cattle to any direction that it is. So the government of Nigeria came in with lots of proposals. They put farming settlements or herder settlements. But somehow the word ranching had not been very, very popular. And so some governments and the states put limitations, banning roaming cattle, and it had become very political, just as you have rightly said. So the National Livestock Transformation Plan with the UN supported doing its programs too with the support from the Human Security Trust Fund and the Peacebuilding Support Office has been trying to see how we can put elements of dialogue, elements of alternative livelihoods for people and communities, and so coming also with demonstrated ranching law scales so that we can begin to change that culture. But it's a very toxic, politically toxic issue, just like Ambassador Campbell has said. Talking about the desertification, I think the government of Nigeria has been pushing for this infamous Green Belt project, wherein there's call for tree planting in the northern and the Sahel states in their thousands. The project has been going on, and because of what we are talking about, the climate change, the cattle, even and all these animals go to destroy. And there's the aim to say, we put that Green Belt, it may contribute to the arrest, to stopping the encroachment of the desert. But of course, the President Buhari was also very pushful, Vanda, with this issue of rewatering of Lake Chad, a project that has not had a lot of unanimity on what should be done. But they believe that if the Lake Chad waters restored, lots and lots of things will be, would follow. But it's very expensive. It's also very, very critical, very difficult to do. And more and more experts, and one of the papers that I wrote also, the issue that it cannot just come as one. You know, it will be very costly for to take water, whether from the Congo Basin or from the Libyan aquifers or wherever they want to do it. It should be accompanied by some economically viable projects that people begin to see that their investments will pay off. And I think that is one of the ways to begin to consider looking at all those issues. But as you have said, the farmer headers issue is very political, political in the sense that it has been looked at it from the point of view where the government in power was some sort of very silent when it was taking a peak, and it becomes very difficult. And even now at the level of the region, ECOWAS is many countries, Benin Republic has suspended the ECOWAS transhumance protocol, and many countries are questioning whether cattle will begin to move from one part of the region, even if it's a tradition, how that can be stopped. So this is something on the table, and the UN in Nigeria is supporting to bring that platform for discussion. Over.
Excellent. Thank you, Shaban. Would you like to come in on this issue?
Just very briefly to say that it's been highlighted here, but I think it's it bears repeating, is, you know, you have all of the conditions, I think, in the Northwest and starting in the Middle Belt, of these tensions being not only exacerbated by, but also taken advantage of by various armed actors. And we've seen this in other places to really terrible outcomes. So it's clearly a case where if we're all focused on prevention, but sometimes I think the narrow focus on sort of counterterrorism prevention, it misses these opportunities potentially because it's so focused on sort of ideological drivers or things like that, that it doesn't see these very practical other types of conflicts that are creating a space where armed actors, including terrorist groups that are of high concern to the United States, are moving in to take advantage of. So just to sort of highlight that, which you've highlighted before, and how important that is to kind of preempt in the Northwest potentially.
Thank you. That's very important. And indeed, the issue of local community reconciliation, local dialogues, is often potent if extremely complex, time-consuming and resource-consuming. And we are seeing same issues in Somalia, that often the best way to reduce conflict is to invest in that. Yet it is so underemphasized, both in international efforts as well as, frankly, in national government's efforts. We are at the end, but I will take the prerogative of running 4 minutes over and ask the last question to Ambassador Campbell before thanking all of our panelists and the audience. Ambassador Campbell, East Africa is coping with what people call scramble for Africa again. Intense competition between global powers and regional powers, UAE, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, China, of course, United States, Europe, over access, priority arrangements, political arrangements. Are we seeing anything similar in West Africa, particularly in Nigeria? Is there a similar power competition playing out? What's the role of China in Nigeria? I know I'm giving you an enormously complex and rich topic with very short amount of time, but your last concluding thoughts, please.
It is not nearly as developed in West Africa as it is in East Africa. Chinese economic penetration of Nigeria is in its relatively early stages. It may amount to something more than it is now. The Buhari administration appears interested in the general proposition of exchange of oil for infrastructure. And the Chinese companies are in the process of restoring the Nigerian railway network. The extent to which Nigerians dislike and are suspicious of the Chinese is very hard to parse out. There's some polling data that indicates that the Chinese are quite popular in Nigeria, but there is plenty of anecdotal evidence that Nigerians regard Chinese as racist. So I would suggest that that this is something through which we do not see very clearly at present time. The other thing, of course, is what happens in China. Will China be able to extend its activities in Africa, particularly should it face economic difficulties of its own?
Oh, thank you, sir. And of course, there is a huge role of China in West Africa, which has to do with deforestation and logging that you already spoke about, as well yes. as with wildlife trafficking, as well as legal wildlife trade and the levels of hunting and poaching that is being conducted in West Africa and heads to China, as well as for that matter as supplies of exotic pets in the United States. Ambassador Campbell, thank you so much for your enormous insight, very rich, very pithy. You gave us a tremendous amount. And thank you also for writing the great book on Nigeria that I highly recommend to everyone, Nigeria and the Nation State. Ms. Michaels, we couldn't have done a panel as well if we didn't have you. Your on-the-ground perspectives are just crucial. And so is your dedication and courage, along with your other humanitarian colleagues working in the North. Thank you so much for coming and your work. And many thanks also to you, Dr. Suifon, for your tremendous policy insight, your deep understanding of both the UN's role, local situation, and Nigerian policies. It's been a great pleasure having you with us. And finally, Dr. O'Neill, thank you also very much for a very extensive collaboration between us that goes beyond this panel and your tremendous insight. And I look forward to learning very much from the outcomes and findings of your project as they emerge. And finally, tremendous thanks to everyone who has joined the conversations for your questions. The event will stay recorded on our Brookings website, and I look forward to having you with us with future events.